want to welcome everyone this evening to the community lecture series of the Old Seder Taylor Road Synagogue. Our opening lecture this evening, of course, is Rabbi Gifter. Our theme of the season is diversity and orthodoxy, and we'd ask Rabbi Gifter to present to us his perspective of our community, the role of the yeshiva, the vital importance of the yeshiva in the decade ahead. So without further ado, I'd like to call upon Rabbi Gifter.
Good evening, my friends. When I was asked to speak tonight on the influence of the Telza Yeshiva upon the Jewish community, I wasn't aware of the fact that it was part of a discussion on diversity in Orthodox Judaism. You see, my friends, I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I'm a Torah Jew. Orthodoxy is strange to me. For years and years, I've been saying this over and over again, that this Greek term, Orthodox, doesn't quite well describe what we Torah Jews believe in. And therefore, I will not be engaged in orthodoxy tonight, but rather in speaking a bit about Torah Jews. And it's true that Telza Yeshiva has done quite a bit for the Cleveland community. It's nearly 50 years, I think. Next year will be the 50th anniversary since we came to Cleveland. I didn't come here when the yeshiva came. I came 2 years later when I was asked by the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Bloch, Zichrono Livroche, and Rav Katz, Zichrono Livroche, to leave the rabbinate. I was in the rabbinate, and it was a lucrative rabbinate. And I was able to be a Torah Jew in the rabbinate, although my congregants were far from that. But they listened to everything I said as far as the community was concerned. As individuals, they were far from Torah Jews, and very far from what you would call Orthodox Jews. But it was a wonderful kehillah in Waterbury, Connecticut. But when my uncles, Zichrono Livroche, the Rosh Yeshiva, asked me to leave the rabbinate and come to the yeshiva to help them in the work of building up the yeshiva here, I said, I'm going to do it. It means giving up a great deal as far as Parnosa is concerned and many other things, but it also means building toilet. And I didn't feel that in Waterbury I would be able to begin building toilet, even though we had begun the beginnings of a day school, the kindergarten. And that was continued by the wonderful colleague of mine who followed me there, who built a complete day school in Waterbury, Rabbi Gewirtz, Zolalang Lem. So I left Waterbury, I left the rabbinate, came here to Cleveland. Rabbi Bloch used to say, because many people asked him, what's the Gefahr in Cleveland? You had no better place to establish a yeshiva, way out in the Midwest in Cleveland. New York. So he said, New York, New York's packed with yeshivas. Every street corner has a yeshiva. In those days, every day school in New York was called yeshiva. Every day school was called yeshiva. So it's full of yeshivas. So I want to go to a place where the term yeshiva is completely strange and start working there. But Cleveland in those days was one of the world centers of reform and conservative Judaism. Rabbi Abihail Silver, world-renowned, the Reform rabbi, and Rabbi Barnett Brickner, the other Reform rabbi, very well-renowned throughout the world, and Park Synagogue, the conservative center. This was Cleveland. Orthodoxy, you can get an idea of what it was. The guest speaker at the Chibas Yerushalayim Shul, the biggest Orthodox congregation in those days in Cleveland, was either Barnett Brickner or Abihail Silver. Would you believe it? That was Cleveland. And we came here to build a yeshiva. People thought we were crazy. But today testifies to the fact that we did a good job and Tells here in Cleveland was one of the centers of the rebirth of Torah in the United States. Torah in its essence. Today we have many more yeshivas, not day schools, but yeshivas in this country. Thank the good Lord for that. But Tells has tried to maintain its tradition as one of the great yeshivas from overseas. Yeshiva there was one of five great Torah centers in Lithuanian Jewry. There were yeshivas in Hungarian Jewry and yeshivas in Polish Jewry. But in Lithuanian Jewry there were five yeshivas. And one of those five yeshivas was Tells, established in 1885. It did a wonderful job overseas. But Hitler brought about the job that had to be done here in the United States. I doubt whether he had an idea of what his destruction of Jewry would lead to. And I keep telling the story that the Chaim Volozhiner, the first and great yeshiva of Lithuanian Polish Jewry, once burst out crying, "The last station for Torah before the coming of Mashiach will be the United States of America." And one of his great disciples asked him, "So why does the Rebbe cry? What's there to cry about?" His answer was, "I see how bitter it will be to create this last station." No one understood what he's talking about, what he was talking about. When Hitler came along, we began to understand what Reb Chaim Volozhiner had in mind. It's a station for Torah brought about by the destruction of European Torah. Whether it be Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, Romania, completely destroyed. Lithuanian Jewry, in my day, existed with 93,000 Jews. There were left 3,000 Jews as a result of the war. Hungary had more left. Poland, many more left. Lithuania was practically completely, totally destroyed. This home of so much toil down through the years. And it had to be reestablished. It had to have a new station. The United States became that station. And Telz was the first European yeshiva that reestablished in the United States. It was followed by Lakewood, established by Rabban Kotler, Zichrono Livroche. But the first yeshiva of European origin was Telz, established in Cleveland. And from that day on, nearly now 50 years, the job of Telz has been continuing. What it has created, not merely for the community, but it has created Torah in South America, in Australia, many other countries, in South Africa, through the student body of the yeshiva. And they brought into these various stations from other yeshivas. The first yeshiva day school in South Africa, in Johannesburg, was established by a student of the yeshiva, Reb David Senders. I think that most of you know who he was and who he is. Was continued by another student who is still there, leading that school. Today there's a kollel in Johannesburg. These are unbelievable things. And so it is in Australia. So it is in many cities in the United States, where students of Telz went there for the domicile, to become inhabitants of the community. But you can't be a Telzer in a community without Torah. So Torah was established in many, many communities throughout the country. How successful we have been in maintaining the tradition of Telz here at the yeshiva, I cannot say, because there's a vast difference between Telz 50 years ago and Telz today. There are a few of us left who saw Telz overseas. Very few. In other yeshivas throughout the country, there are none, the leaders of the yeshivas, who ever had the privilege of seeing Torah overseas. Here there are a few still in existence. I happen to be one of them. I had the privilege, only privilege, there's no other word for it, to study Torah overseas, to see what Torah study means without the comforts and luxuries of the United States. To come from the United States into a yeshiva where there were no inside bathrooms. You had to go outside in the cold weather of European winters. It's far from comfortable, I can assure you. the food that we had at home in the United States, we didn't have it there. My good friend Rabbi Paperman, he's a Baltimorean, and I'm a Baltimorean, originally a Virginian. I'm not a European. I'm a Native American, coming from the country of Jefferson, Madison, and Washington. I don't know how many Americans today know what that means. But in our day in this country, we did know about these things. Today, other subjects are taught. This Baltimorean didn't know me from Baltimore. He was from East Baltimore. My parents had a little business in West Baltimore. Two worlds. It cost 10 cents for the streetcar fare. 5 cents to go from West Baltimore to East Baltimore. Another 5 cents to return. That's 10 cents. Not all of us possessed 10 cents. So we didn't know each other from there. We got to know each other from pills overseas. What were the comforts? Rabbi Paperman, in pills, he was a poor American. He couldn't afford a cup of coffee every morning. He drank chicory. Some of you, I guess, know what that means. Chicory. What are you doing? Huh? Not coffee. Oh, no. Huh? What? I don't know what you're saying. Chicory. Chicory. In English, we call it chicory. A soft-boiled egg? Who ever heard of such a thing in Tells in the morning? He didn't have it. He was a poor fellow. He couldn't afford to pay for that. It was black bread, some schmierichts, not butter. I don't remember what the schmierichts was. And chichorie. That was breakfast. That's the way we studied overseas. I'm not mentioning myself because I was a rich American. I could afford coffee, and I could afford a soft-boiled egg, and I could afford other comforts. And we studied Torah under such conditions. I wish you would have been able to see the joy of Torah study overseas. I'll tell you another little story. We used to go walking in the afternoon between the end of the first Seder after lunch and the beginning of the second of the afternoon session. It started at 4. So we used to take a walk, always in pairs, so we didn't waste time talking about nothing, but we used to discuss problems in Talmud studies. Would you believe that the Goyim, the Litvishi Goyim, they were very uncultured. They used to beg us, come and walk in our fields. So we used to tell them, what do you mean, walk in your fields? We'll tread on the corn that grows there. No, walk in the fields. When we ask for the explanation, because we do not know why, but we know that in those fields where the Telzer Yeshiva Bochlim walk, the blessings of God rest there, and the fruits that grow forth are beyond belief. Goyim used to tell us that. Come and walk in our fields. That's what Torah study was overseas. From the early morning to the late hours of the night. But after 12, my father-in-law, who was the mashgiach of the yeshiva, used to come over to us and tell us, you must go to sleep, because if you won't sleep, you won't be able to study during the day. You must go to sleep. There was one youngster, he was the son of a rov in Lithuania, who used to come in, and my father-in-law used to put the lights out. He was afraid they wouldn't listen to him. So he used to put the lights out. This youngster used to, and lock the door. This youngster, I can't forget him. When he saw that the yeshiva wasn't there, and my father-in-law, the mashgiach, had already left, so he used to crawl in through the window, and he found a way to put the lights back on again. And he used to study in the yeshiva b'smedrash till the early hours of morning. That's the way Torah was studied overseas. I can't begin to tell you what the ta'anug, the joy, the pleasure of Torah study meant to the entire student body and what it meant to the community as a whole. What it meant to the Lithuanian Jewry, except naturally those who were totally strange to the elements of Torah study. But every community in Lithuania had Jews who were devoted to Torah, and their children were sent to these great centers, five centers in Lithuania, where Torah was studied, propagated, and through them handed on to various other communities. Hitler took care of all that. Very few remained. But those who did remain and carried with them this heritage, some of them came to the United States also, and they carried on that great heritage. That's the beginning of TELS in Cleveland, TELS in the United States. I'm one of the few left in this generation who had the privilege of Torah study overseas. At the age of 17, I was in TELS. I turned 17 on the ship traveling over the ocean to TELS. And there I was for a little bit over 5 years. Came back to visit wonderful parents, Aleihem HaSholom, who gave so much of themselves not to see a child in over 5 years. Here, when you come to study Torah in yeshivas, as in Lahavdil in the colleges, you're home every 2 months. Winter vacation, summer vacation, Bein Hazmanim, you're always home. Then over 5 years, parents didn't see the child. And I came back here with a thought in mind that I would return to that great center of Torah. But that thought was changed by Hitler. Because during the time of my visit home in Baltimore, Hitler went through the Axis with Mussolini, and I recognized that we're on the verge of a terrible, terrible destruction of Jews and Judaism. And I did not therefore return. And I had seen what was true? It was so. And therefore I am one of those numbered individuals who can still talk about Torah overseas, talk about it with memories of the joy that we enjoyed in Torah study without luxury. Torah itself is luxury. Torah itself is ta'anug. There can be no greater ta'anug in life than the study of Torah. And do you know why? Because in the study of Torah, we speak with the Almighty. We don't just speak with our friend, my study partner. We don't just speak with my Rebbe, who is my teacher. They are all conveyances to the Almighty. When I don't understand something, I'm speaking to Him, Ribbono Shel Olam, clarify it to me. If I'm worthy of it, He'll do it. If I'm unworthy of it, it remains an unanswered question. And there are many unanswered questions to me and to many others greater than me, the greats of all generations. Not always are we worthy that the Almighty should hearken to our prayer. Answer me, Ribbono Shel Olam. What does the Torah mean? Not always does He answer. These are things that we pray about in our daily prayers. We never stop to think of it. But overseas in the yeshiva, we felt it. That when we study Torah, we are engaged in a study of something with the Ribbono Shel Olam Himself. So how can one not be filled with joy and elation? Is there any other opportunity to be able to speak with the Almighty Himself? That's what yeshiva life means. That's what it means here in this country also. Boys studying yeshiva. American youngsters studying yeshiva. Their study means a discussion with the Ribbono Shel Olam to understand the intricacies of various laws by which we live, whether it be the laws of damages, whether it be the laws of Yom Tov and Shabbos. When I once spoke in Cleveland Western Reserve University and explained to them our approach to Talmudic study, what to us is the meaning of the law of damages, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, they were astounded beyond words, to such an extent that, believe it or not, the head of the law school, he is no more, the head of the law school came over to me and asked me, would the rabbi condescend to come to us once a week and lecture on Talmudic studies? I told him I would be more than happy. But my duties at the yeshiva are such that I don't have the time for it. A weekly lecture, I don't have the time for it. But imagine a non-Jew, a professor of law, becomes overwhelmed hearing what Talmudic study signifies. So how can it possibly be possible that a Jewish student should study in a yeshiva and not be overcome with the joy of Talmudic study. What hurts me is that there's so few of us left who still remember what Torah was overseas and try to hand this down and implant it within their Talmidim. I have wonderful Talmidim at the yeshiva. Canadians, Americans, South Africans. Wonderful Talmidim. And I must tell you that they are also overwhelmed with what they hear from me about what Torah was. So overwhelmed that they studied Torah in depth here in the United States. From all these countries. That's what tells a yeshiva represents in this country. We have students from Eretz Yisrael also studying at the yeshiva. Students from various countries. Students from various states. From the Pacific to the Atlantic. Baruch Hashem, the Jews are interested in Torah study. What it means to a community is beyond words. You heard what this community was when we came here. Today, it's a world center.